This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 282 was recorded on July 29th, 2021. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by Abex Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better meet the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Escrow.com, the world's most secure online payment system from a counterparty risk perspective because the funds sit in escrow. Shard Capital strategist and alternative investments chief Bill Blaine joins me as a first-time feature interview guest. Bill says secular inflation is here to stay and then goes on to explain several less obvious nuances of the finance industry's readiness for the coming change. We'll also discuss precious metals, bond yields, and much more. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview when Patrick's chart deck is titled Post-FOMC Market Moves.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Eric, let's jump to that S&P 500. We broke to a 52-week high. Didn't take too long, did it?
Patrick, the melt-up continues. I think it is an Austrian crack-up boom. Why is it continuing? Well, I think that the Delta scare is abating. And just to be clear about that, I'm not saying that the risk of the Delta variant of the virus is abating. I think what's going on is the scare that it was going to crash financial markets is abating. And the thing is, the threat to humanity is as real as ever. This is a big deal, this pandemic. But we're getting to the point where there's just no public tolerance for a continued lockdown situation. The economy is going to reopen, virus or no virus. And I think that is the conclusion the market's coming to. Accordingly, we're seeing the melt up continue.
All right, Eric, let's move on to that U.S. dollar, because in the post-FOMC period, we certainly see the U.S. dollar backing off. I plan on putting up a chart here on the Euro-USD when we get into the post game. But what's your take on the first reactions here?
Patrick, before the FOMC, we were approaching resistance, but now what's happened is we've rolled over, and post-FOMC, that acceleration to the downside says to me that, you know, we're really in just a consolidation between 89 and, I don't know, 93.50, something like that. And I think that until we see a significant sustained breakout out of that range, this market is just consolidating.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil, because we obviously the other week had a big drop on the downside, but the bounce has come back in and we're almost a stone's throw away from the previous highs. Do you think that that was just a quick little dip and now oil's just going to head up to $80+? And how did the inventory numbers come in?
Well, let's start with inventory, Patrick. Crude oil drawing down 4.1 million barrels. That's a big drawdown, but you know, considering that people were expecting a whole bunch of drawdowns of 10 million barrels plus, it's not a super big drawdown as some have expected. Cushing, Oklahoma drawing down 1.3 million barrels, but the drawdowns continue across the board, not just in crude, but in the finished products, with gasoline drawing down 2.3 million barrels and distillates drawing down 3.1 million barrels. So that's 9.5 million barrels of both crude oil and products drawn down. U.S. production moved down two ticks, 200,000 barrels down to 11.2 million barrels. Inventory data is bullish here, but I think the Delta variant fears have been the bearish factor that's been preventing the market from moving higher. I think as people are coming to their senses and realizing the Delta variant is a big threat to public health, but it's not really the threat to, you know, shutting down airline travel and things that people feared. We're going to reopen the economy, especially to fully vaccinated people, and I think that demand is going to come back. So I still expect a rally in August up to somewhere between $80 and $92 per barrel as a final high, which I think happens before Labor Day. And, you know, is that something that is really going to happen or just wishful thinking on my part because I'm long? It really comes down to the inventory numbers in August. Some analysts were predicting 50 million barrels. That's 50 million barrels of crude oil inventory drawdowns in the month of August alone. So that would be, say, you know, 12 or 13 million barrels a week for every week in August. If that really happens, I think we're going to $90. If that doesn't really happen, and those were exaggerated estimates, and it's really 5 or 6 million barrels, I don't know that we get to $90, but I think we get over 80. We'll see what happens. The real test comes in August, though, and see how those inventory draws match expectations.
All right. Well, I was looking forward to touching on gold here because week after week, it seemed like gold was just doing nothing and it's trading in a sideways trade range. And then suddenly today, especially in that post-FOMC period, as real yields turn more negative, gold finally has a breakout. Do you think this breakout's going to stick?
Well, my hunch is that it's going to stick, but I emphasize the word hunch. I like to work from data, and the data is not persuasive yet. What we need to see is a daily close and a sustained move over 1839, which is where the 55 and 200-day moving averages are co-located. And we're still, you know, we're at resistance. We're right on those numbers, but we haven't moved above it yet. So the close over is going to be the final confirmation. I think we're going to get it in the next few days, but, you know, you don't want to jump the gun. Right now, we're at resistance. If anything, if you're the swing trader, you're tempted to sell here. I wouldn't be selling here. I'd be waiting for the breakout to happen. But as far as acting on the breakout, it hasn't happened yet.
All right. Well, let's touch on the 10-year Treasury yield, which after running pretty strong for the last month or two, the last week, we've been really trading sideways here and consolidating. You think that's it for the move in rates?
Patrick, no real change to my view. As long as we're below 1.5, I think we're in a comfortable zone where nobody's freaking out about the bond market crashing. And, you know, we'll see what happens. As far as whether the yields go much lower, as some people have predicted, would take a lot, but we'll see. Anything is possible. I think it really comes down to monetary policy and fiscal policy, and these are moving targets. You know, we actually had President Biden tell people the other day that we don't need to worry about inflation because they're going to pump so much money into the economy that inflation won't be a problem. Okay, that's actually not a view we've had on Macro Voices. Maybe President Biden has the new math or something. I don't know, but we're going to need to wait and see how all of this policy stuff gets sorted out. And the folks that are driving the bus in terms of being in charge of policy don't really see macroeconomics the way I see it.
This week's feature interview guest is Shard Capital strategist Bill Blaine. Eric, why did we invite Bill onto the show this week?
Well, Bill has gotten a lot of attention on Zero Hedge and elsewhere with a lot of outspoken views. And, you know, he runs alternative assets. He has an inflation view that we're going to discuss at length. And he's thinking really seriously about what are the asset classes that you want to be in. You know, he's the alternative assets guy for Shard Capital. So he just seems like a really good person to talk to about not only this secular inflation trend, but what do you do about it in terms of investment strategy?
Well, Eric's interview with Bill Blaine is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
This episode of Macro Voices was brought to you by Abex, a fintech company traded under ticker symbol ABXXF on the OTCQX in the United States and ABXX on the Equitas Neo in Canada. Abex was founded on the principle of creating market-based solutions to solve the world's most challenging problems. Two of these issues in particular, the energy transition and climate change, are creating once-in-a-generation opportunities for investors. Abex is leveraging proprietary Web 3.0 technologies to digitize and accelerate the velocity and security of commodity trading markets, beginning with liquefied natural gas and carbon. Investors seeking exposure to the fintech applications powering this new era of the ESG economy can visit www.abex.tech or www.abex.exchange, or check out ABXX on the Equitas Neo or ABXXF on the OTCQX exchanges.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Bill Blaine, strategist and head of alternative assets for Shard Capital, and probably better known as the author of Blaine's Morning Porridge, one of the most intriguing investment blogs on the internet. Bill, it's great to have you on as a first-time guest. I've been asking everybody about inflation. Janet says it is transitory. I think my favorite quote that I've heard so far is, World War II was transitory. What do you make of this transitory argument? Is inflation here to stay? Is this a secular phenomenon? And what does it mean?
Yeah, I'm rather the opinion that inflation is not only here to stay, but the most significant thing that's going on is we have long-term inflation is now being imported into the real world from distorted financial assets. Everybody tells me that there's no inflation out there and what we're seeing is just a transitory spike caused by supply chains breaking down and things like the chip shortage and people who are anticipating a fast recovery. But what we're really seeing is all the inflation that's been generated over the last 12 years of monetary experimentation, quantitative easing, and buying back bonds and keeping interest rates artificially low, that's generated tremendous inflation in financial assets. And that financial asset inflation is now creeping into the real world. So you're going to see a whole series of effects, inflationary moves that occur as a result of that. Plus, I think we're also going into a very different world that is not going to be one where you can easily simply brush off inflation effects as transitory. I mean, let's just think for one second about some real world events that have just occurred, like all these climate disasters we've seen in the last month. They cause real costs. These costs have to be paid from somewhere, and that is going to be inflationary in its own right. So I think we really have moved into a new world where inflation is going to start really impacting bottom lines again.
Bill, you and I both know that nothing ever happens in a straight line in finance. And something I've been pondering is, boy, I really think, as you do, that this inflation is here to stay. But it's gone an awful ways, especially in assets like copper that have just been up so much since the bottom of the COVID crisis. And I've been thinking, boy, it's awfully late to be coming into a market like that with new money. Now, I had Darius Dale on last week. His perspective, he agrees with us on secular inflation, but he says all of his signals are saying, look, that disinflationary wave that wrong-foots investors, at least in the intermediate term, that's here now. And he's saying, get ready for some disinflation before the bigger picture inflation resumes. What do you think of that view? Should we be thinking that maybe it's gone a little too far and there's a pullback before this trend continues?
Okay, well, that is a very interesting and intriguing perspective. And I think he's probably right because, you know, we've got effectively a deflationary environment that is caused by ultra low interest rates. I was asked a question recently about what do you think about Europe keeping interest rates lower for longer? And I turned around and said, well, to answer that question, you need to understand what's happened to Japan. For 20 years, they've had ultra-low interest rates. And what has been the effect? A deflationary economy. But we still have this inflationary backdrop to the global economy, and you can't separate the two. Now, it's not necessarily a Japanese thing, but I think we are going to experience multiple different things going on. And the big word that scares me more than any other is stagnation. Now, I grew up in the 1970s and 80s in the United Kingdom, where we suffered incredible stagflation during the 1970s that caused all kinds of social problems, where you had massive inflation and jobs collapsing. It didn't matter what you did to interest rates, you couldn't change that. And so although we're talking about an inflationary threat, you also have this secondary effect that could be deflationary in certain markets. And I think copper is an interesting one to talk about there, because we clearly saw copper prices getting bid up in anticipation of a very strong recovery to the pandemic. Everyone piled into copper expecting that copper as effectively a proxy for tech sales would work. Same thing happened in lumber, because of course we saw the most incredible market in lumber. Again, people anticipating recovery. And we will see inflation as a result of that. It's occurring at the moment in the shops. You try and buy a fridge and it's 10% higher because of the copper price spike, but copper's already down. What if we get a situation where you've got real inflation in prices, but you have a deflationary economy? That's a classic recipe for this stagflation threat.
Bill, you and I grew up in the 70s, but we were kids at the time. And frankly, the guys that were working in the industry and were around in the late 60s when the onset of secular inflation began, they're all retired. And one of the biggest things I think about is, okay, who's going to be in charge of rounding up all the guys that have been through this before when this secular inflation really hits the tape? Where's the finance industry going to know what to do? Because I think everybody who knows is gone or retired.
This is one of the things that really scares me, because the reason we're in this environment at the moment is a game of consequences. Everything that happens, everything you do today will have a consequence tomorrow. And the big issue for central banks, for it is they we are talking about, central banks have been experimenting with monetary policy since the great financial crisis began in 2007. And in 2009, they came up with this brilliant idea that they could kickstart the economy with ultra-low interest rates, and they would get money to flow into the economy by buying back bonds, which means that investors would sell their bonds and then use that money to invest in the real economy. But that's not the way that trading works, we all know. What investors did was, of course, they sold their bonds to central banks and then bought more bonds to sell to central banks. And they used money from that to buy yet more bonds to sell to central banks. And this is what caused massive inflation in financial assets. The path of that happening was very simple. Interest rates started to fall. As a result, people saw that the yields and bonds were unsustainably low for their investment purposes. So they started going what we call yield tourism. And they started buying equity. Now remember, equity is a much higher risk market. And they started buying so much equity that the equity market went up and the dividend yields and equities also came down. Now, that has been the consequence of ultra-low interest rates, massive inflation in financial assets. But here's the critical thing. That started 12 years ago. Now, 12 years in financial markets is an incredibly long time. The result is there's practically nobody under the age of 35 in the city, in the what we in the UK call the city, but the world calls global finance, who understands investment markets where it's not completely normal for central banks to be repressing interest rates and distorting yields through their monetary experimentation and quantitative easing. So every single fund manager under the age of 35 thinks this is perfectly normal. And that's why when I'm out doing my job as an alternative asset investor, I see a great divide between those of us over 40 and those below 40 who've got completely different perspectives on what value propositions are. If you're younger, you tend to think that value is all about the price set by the market as in a distorted market. Whereas anybody over 40, we're tearing our hair out and we're going, what is going on here? How can we accept interest rates being so distorted? Look at the effects. Look at the overvaluations. Look at the crazy stories that are created. So that point you just made about where are all the old guys? Well, you know, those of us who've been around the block a few times, and the first time I traded treasury bonds back in, I think, 1986, I think we were talking then about the beginning of the big bull rally in bonds, where the year before, traders were frightening me with stories about how yields had been 18%, and they were down in double digits still when I started trading. And now, where are we on the 10-year? 1.2 or something like that? This is a completely different world, and there are very few of us left who remember what it was like.
The theory that I've had about this is when we get runaway inflation, and of course, a lot of people would say that's not even in the cards. A deflationary backdrop is just too strong. It's never going to happen. I don't claim to be smart enough to know when it's going to happen. But my argument is this. If we have a runaway inflation, I think that suddenly the central bankers' hands are tied, because all of a sudden the norm, the new normal that you're talking about, which is, hey, whatever goes wrong, they're just going to print money and that's going to fix it. Yeah. When you get runaway inflation, you can't do that anymore. And if the central bankers' hands are tied, I don't think the industry knows what to do. Am I crazy to think that? And how realistic is it that this eventually gets to a runaway inflation kind of scenario?
You know, it's a very interesting question to ask. What instruments are there for actually controlling inflation? The typical way you would control inflation would be to let interest rates rise. But if you were to do that today, the effect would be a massive collapse in financial markets, which are now completely addicted to the opium of cheap money. So you would end up creating massive defaults, massive job losses, complete loss of confidence across the economy. But then how do you stem inflationary bursts going around? Well, you got to then think about what creates inflation. And, you know, inflation is not just oil prices going up, as happened in the 1970s. Inflation is not just a drought season putting up the price of bread. Inflation this time is going to be a mix of very real inflation coming in from events, like I described earlier, some of the costs that we're going to have to bear now for extreme weather events, the wildfires in California, the flooding in Germany and China, all these things. But also we'll see inflation seeping in from financial assets. And the way that's happening, if you take a look at what hedge funds are doing today, hedge funds are not buying treasury bonds, and they've stopped bothering buying things like stocks and shares. They're now buying real assets. Just earlier today, the reason I'm up at Edinburgh, Scotland today is I'm visiting my mother. And I went and did the shopping for her this morning in Morrison's. Morrison's, one of the big UK supermarket chains. And you know what? It's just been acquired by a group of hedge funds because it's a real asset. And it's been acquired at an incredibly high price that nobody thought Morrison's was worth. No one else was going to bid that for it. But that's an example of inflation in the real world, pushing up the price of real assets. Now, eventually that gets down to the penny in people's pockets. And that's when we really start to see inflation occur that starts to change the way that people behave in an economy. And I think that's already beginning. You've seen some incredible moves in house prices in the USA and the UK. Now, the US housing market's just had a bit of a blip from the last numbers, but here in the UK, house prices are now completely out with the scale that normal people could think about buying. All they can do is go and rent. And that's another example of inflation, because that means the money they were going to spend on buying a house, and now they can't ever afford a house, is just money they spend on consumption. And if people are consuming lots, well, guess what? That causes real inflation as well. And that's all driven by ultra-low interest rates.
Bill, as we're recording this interview on Tuesday afternoon, the news that seems to be hitting the tape hardest beyond the Delta strain of COVID, which of course has been big news for several weeks, this week it seems to be China talks and China negotiations are really starting to spook markets. Let's start with what's going on, but then after that, I want to move on to the bigger picture of what's the relationship with China and the future of China going to mean to the macro economy?
That's an absolutely fascinating question. I mean, if we talk just for 1 second about what's the relationship between the two big powers on the planet today, the USA and China, well, people have described it, and I'm not sure if I'm going to pronounce this, as Thaiducius's trap. Thaiducius, and again, apologies if I pronounced it wrong, was a famous Athenian politician who very quickly realized that war between Sparta and Athens was absolutely inevitable, as Athens started to challenge Sparta's military dominance of the Greek city-states. The result at the end of the day was they destroyed themselves, and within a few years, Rome had conquered the whole of Greece. But there's a lot of people who do think that that's the way that we're going to see it play out between China and the USA. I'm not so sure myself. I'm not going to paint myself as a predictor of global events. But I think it's far more likely that two very clever nations will find a way to live together. And that's what's causing the interest in financial markets at the moment. When we talk about the USA today, after the events of the COVID pandemic and the way in which government has stepped in, and this is not just the Biden administration, but previously Trump's administration, government has stepped in and supported the economy with massive bailouts and provided cash where required to keep companies open. We have a right-wing government under Trump that acted in the most socialist way imaginable. In the UK, we currently have a Conservative government which has done exactly the same thing and pursued policies that put the Socialist Labour Party and make them look extremely right-wing because they provided so much support for the economy. In contrast, the Chinese government, a communist party, has done very little. They've really held back on supporting the economy but encouraged the economy through capital availability. Now, it's pretty clear to me if I step back and look that both economies are effectively capitalist. At the bottom of the day, the success of the US is down to its entrepreneurship, its inventiveness, and its ability to innovate these inventions. The success of China is being able to create capitalism with Chinese characteristics, which we all take to means that they're not terribly innovative and they steal ideas from others. Well, you know, that may be or may not be true, but the fact is they've created a very effective economy very quickly. And what we're seeing in the market just now is really games being played, people trying to understand where this is going to go in the future. The Chinese economy is absolutely massive. We know that. It's going to soon be the same size as the US economy. And that's a massive investment opportunity. But the Chinese government takes a very different view, which is why we're seeing them clamp down as they've done in the last few months. Just in the last few days, we've seen them declare that education companies, which we all saw as a massive opportunity to profit from the Chinese market, have been told that they are no longer for-profit companies and they are there to serve the needs for the state. Well, to us, that sounds, well, that's frightening. We've invested all this money in all these free companies, which we expected would be able to harvest enormous returns from the Chinese population who are desperate to send their kids to cramming schools to make sure they get into universities. But from the Chinese perspective, the Chinese realize that they have a whole series of regulatory and especially social problems to solve. And one of these is the success of the one-parent family rules that were introduced back in communist times. As a result, you could only have one child, which meant that the Chinese favored having sons who would keep the family name going and provide for the parents as they get older. But the result is China now faces an enormous demographic, well, actually two demographic problems. The first is China is getting old before it gets rich. And the second is they have a massive imbalance between males and females. There are far more young males than there are young females. Now, don't ask me how that occurred, but it was a form of selection that we would not have tolerated in the West. As a result, the Chinese have got to find ways of encouraging families to have more kids. And one of the ways they're going to do that is by removing the threat of ultra-high costs of educating your kids by making education free and at the same time being able to tell the population that, hey, look what we've done for you. Education is free. Everyone has access. So when you're looking at the divides between Chinese capitalism and Western capitalism, you've got to try and put it into some form of context and understand why it is they've done these things. So I've just explained the thing about education. Clamping down on fintech, as they did with Alipay, and the problems we're now seeing with Tencent, you can explain these in similar ways. It's about the Chinese Communist Party making sure they maintain their control and relevance. But for those of us in the West, we've got to say, you know, sit back and look and say, can we afford to be not invested in this economy? Now, there's lots of reasons not to be invested in China from a sort of social and governance perspective. What they're doing in Hong Kong appalls us. What they're doing to the Uyghurs on the Western fringes appalls us. Their surveillance capitalism is something that doesn't fit here. But at the same time, there's lots of things we do that they don't like either. I suspect the future is we're going to find an accommodation for China, but it's a very difficult market unless you're really prepared to take the time to understand what's going on to try and invest in. I hope that all makes sense because I kind of galloped through about 400 different points in 400 seconds.
Longer term, some people seem to be very concerned that we have an escalating Cold War that could take us to a U.S.-China situation, which is very similar to the U.S.-Soviet situation in the 1960s, say. Is it really that bad, or are people just a little bit over-concerned?
I think we actually face something that's very, very different this time. The Cold War with Soviet Russia was, on the Russian side, an awful lot of bluster. I actually studied Soviet economics when I was at university back in the early 80s. And there was an awful lot of bluster about the economic might of the USSR. Now, there clearly is economic and productive might in China, so that's a fundamental difference. It will really come down to which country innovates faster. But I think, as I said earlier, both countries are far more anxious to find an accommodation, because I don't think that the, the basis between capitalism and Russian communism, which, you know, they were poles apart, but the difference between modern communism, Chinese communism, and Western capitalism, that's not so far apart. I think what we're going to find is that there'll be an accommodation found.
Bill, coming back to the inflation theme, you know, a lot of people, myself included, have really looked at gold as an inflation hedge. Frankly, there is a counter argument, although I disagree with parts of it. You can't argue that gold has not performed as well as some of us thought it might. And cryptocurrency seems to be at least the younger generation's favored currency debasement and inflation hedge. Has gold become your grandfather's Oldsmobile, or is it more likely that the crypto guys just don't realize the risk they're taking?
Yeah, that's a fascinating question. I think there is definitely a behavioral link between the way that people understand gold and what they think about cryptos. And that's maybe worth talking for a second. Let me come straight up and say that I think cryptos are a complete and utter scam. I can see absolutely nothing that a cryptocurrency can do that currencies don't already do better and gold doesn't already do better. And, you know, it's dead easy to say, enjoy yourself being poor, but there's no real fundamentals behind it. When the pandemic started, and I immediately predicted a massive economic shock, even before we started lockdowns, one of the first things I did was transfer a large portion of what I was doing into gold, in the expectation that we would see gold not only as an inflation hedge, because we expected supply chain disruptions, but also because I could see it being a flight to safety hedge as well. So I put cash into portfolio cash into gold and into treasuries and UK gilts. That's the UK government bond market. And I've been kind of surprised at the way that gold has not performed better, because you've got two classic gold pluses going on, which is uncertainty and inflation. But yet people haven't gone for gold. And I sort of look at the crypto thing, and let's be honest, you know, cryptos, you know, for all the trillions they talk about being invested in Coinbase and all the other exchanges, that's still a fraction of the gold markets. Yet it has got people thinking, are there alternative ways to hedge? And I thought it was very interesting that you mentioned your grandfather's Oldsmobile. I mean, one of the things I collect is art. And unfortunately, I've bought all the wrong things. They haven't gone up in the kind of a way you want, because you just don't know or understand how the fashion market for what is going to become big in art is going to develop. And I suspect that's also slightly true of what's going on in crypto, because there are so many different choices now.
Bill, you run alternative assets for Shard Capital. Now, from everything that you've said, I'm assuming that you're focusing more on real assets, not just gold, but other things like real estate and so forth. You know, real estate's not exactly cheap. It's hard to be a value investor and also focus on real assets right now. Where's the value, or where is the hedge if you want to be in the real asset market? Seems like nothing's cheap.
Okay, well, the real asset markets are absolutely fascinating, because they really began in the wake of the great financial crisis that began in 2007. If you remember back then, what we saw was banks under enormous pressure and the regulators and central banks very quickly changing the rules on how banks could use their capital. And effectively, over the next couple of years, we saw that banks stopped being lenders. Yeah, that's what I said. Banks effectively were no longer lenders. They were simply brokers. And what would happen is the banks would go and originate an asset, and then they would find real money to invest in that asset to finance it. And you saw a number of the big pension funds, insurance funds, and particularly smart hedge funds who saw the opportunities in private debt and private equity. And of course, they went out. And while you're getting 1% for investing in US treasuries, you can be getting a very well-constructed risk in private debt, yielding a proper interest rate, say 6, 7%, and often much higher. So I now spend most of my, and I've spent my whole career in the bond market before I got involved in developing the private asset, private debt, and private equity markets as the alternative asset sector. And what we look for is assets that are going to create really attractive yields and are secured on these assets. And some of them we've learned some frightening lessons about. Aircraft is a great one, for instance. Before the pandemic, we assumed that aircraft would retain their value for years, and you could predict exactly what they would be worth in a few months' time and a few years' time. Therefore, you could create secondary markets. Therefore, you could create valuations, and you can sell them based on the resale value and even the scrap value down the line. That's all come to a crashing halt. But other assets, and you mentioned property, you know, property is a fascinating market, especially here in the United Kingdom, where residential property has been on an upward curve since before America was even conceived. I mean, we're talking about 400 years of UK residential property history. And every time we have a crash, within 2 or 3 years, that crash will have been corrected and the market will be slowly edging back up. But what we've seen in the last couple of years is, again, people understanding that the returns that they get from distorted yields in the bond markets and other financial assets means that they need to buy real assets. And of course, property is the one they've gone for. So you've seen UK property not rising 2 or 3% per annum, but 9% was the number that we had yesterday. You know, 9% per annum just means property is running out of the affordability level for most people. But it's a great asset for those that have ready cash. And that money is still piling in, meaning the price is getting higher and higher. Now, that has a number of knock-on effects. It means that there's much greater demand for rental property, which again spells demand for people to buy rental properties, therefore pushing up the price again. But it also means that people give up trying to afford. And that changes their behavior. If they can't afford to ever buy their own home, why bother working so hard? Why not just take the government furlough scheme or just throw yourself in welfare for the rest of your life? So, you know, you got to be careful. All these distortions, the consequences I talked earlier about, they have long-term effects and they're changing the behavior of populations. So I think it's very significant when you see house prices accelerate beyond the reach of the bulk of the population. And this would then lead us on to another of my favorite topics, which is the pernicious effects of wealth inequality. And that's something that I don't think is given enough attention when you see the dearth of opportunities available to many people now and the fact that the world is increasingly becoming divided into haves and have-nots. Now, that may not sound terribly capitalist, but you know the history of Europe tells you that when people don't get good opportunities, they tend to get rebellious. And in France, they revolt.
Bill, I think wealth inequality is the biggest challenge that we face as a society. And what scares me the most is, you know, I think everybody is talking about it. The problem is people are talking the loudest about it, have solutions that I don't think are really solutions. I don't think they really solve anything. I think they'll actually make it worse in the long run. But boy, they sell a heck of a lot better than my solutions do. What do you make of this whole populism trend? And it seems to me, at least in the United States, like this whole MMT phenomenon is really gaining a lot of steam. There's a lot of political support. There's a lot of public support for more nanny state government handouts and so forth. And it seems like Stephanie Kelton and the MMT crowd have the solution for how we're going to print up all that money without having to tax anybody and spend a lot of money. And don't worry, it's not going to be inflationary.
Okay, well, look, the only way to answer that question is to look at the bond markets and understand exactly what sovereign bond markets are. by sovereign bond markets, I mean, let's keep it to the US and the UK. Both are sovereign nations and they have financial sovereignty over their money supply, or they have monetary sovereignty, let's put it that way. There is no way that the UK issuing sterling gilts or the USA issuing dollar bonds is going to go bust. Whatever happens, they can press the printing press and they will repay in dollars or sterling the debt that they've issued. That is the basic premise of new monetary theory, that you can go out and print as much money as you want. The problem then lies in foreign exchange. And if people lose confidence in the USA, and not in its ability to repay, but they know it will repay, but if they lose confidence in the USA because they're concerned about the political situation, or they're concerned that it's losing the war with China, whatever, then they're going to start selling dollars, and that's going to be massively inflationary. Again, coming back to our early chat about inflation. And that's the big risk for any monetary sovereign nation, that although they can always repay their debt, if they lose confidence in the currency, then they will face massive inflation, which damages the nation. That's the simple equation. At the moment, every single nation in the world is involved in a massive money printing binge to afford the costs of the pandemic. That's happening everywhere in Europe, in Asia, China, USA, UK. Everyone's printing money. Latin America, everyone's printing money. When that stops, then people are going to start paying attention to which countries do you actually have confidence in. Now, what countries would you have confidence in? Would you have confidence in a country that is confident in itself in being able to continue printing money to support the growth of the economy? Or would you lend the money to an economy where the government has decided to embark on crushing austerity, where they're suddenly cutting the money that was supporting the economy, putting companies into bankruptcy, causing massive social tensions? Now, the conventional wisdom is that any responsible government will avoid overspending. But in that example I've just quoted to you, it looks far better that the government continues to spend to even out the economy rather than creating an austerity situation which is likely to fuel further wealth inequality. Now, wealth inequality is very important because what we've seen over the last 12 years of monetary experimentation is very, very simple. If you own financial assets, stocks and shares, you have got phenomenally richer because that's where all the inflation has been. And if you didn't own these things, you've got much, much poorer. And of course, financial assets are owned by the richest in society, who have got far wealthier. And when you see that these people are the ones who tend to pay less of their total income in taxes, that causes massive resentment. Now, that is what's driving the populist agendas across the US and especially in Europe. Funnily enough, although we have the same problems in the UK, we're electing right-wing governments. And the reason we're doing that is the sheer incompetence of the left. And you know, sometimes, despite being a Scotsman, which makes me naturally tending towards socialism, you know, sometimes I wish that would continue. But this threat of rising wealth inequality and more wealth being in the hands of fewer and fewer people who can afford to take all the economies, that is bound to create resentment. And that resentment will be far higher in any economy that tries to create confidence by embarking on austerity policies. So it's not an easy thing to simply say invest in nations that look to be the ones that are most careful with their money and create confidence in their currency that way. You really need to be looking at the quality of government, which governments are actually handling the process best. Now, the simple version of MMT, that we can go and spend as much money as we work, doesn't take that into account. And if it's going to work, it's going to have to. And it really goes back to the 1930s when we first talked about the ability of nations to reinflate through fiscal and monetary policy. And I think it's going to be fascinating as we come out of the pandemic, which nations do it well and which do it badly. And it's not just about social spending. And this, is, I think, is the big question for the USA. How is the USA going to make its economy fit for purpose for the future with the massive infrastructure spending? And that's infrastructure in physical goods, but also in goods like education, to make the US fit for purpose for the next 100 years if you have political impasse. And I think it's that political impasse that's the biggest threat to the USA in the coming decade.
I want to move on to another big trend in finance, which is ESG, or environmental, social, and corporate governance-based investing. The idea of the owners of capital taking responsibility to invest in a way that benefits society. Now, I want to go on record as saying that premise, I don't think there's anything more noble or better that I've ever heard in my life. So I'm all for the concept. But frankly, I think this whole ESG thing is a bunch of baloney. I think that what's going on here is, and it, you know, it's very similar in my thinking to what we see in the whole race inequality thing. We absolutely do have a race inequality problem. We have racist issues still. It's amazing to me. We still have racism. But you know what? Burning stuff down is not a way to solve racism. And it seems like ESG has got the same anger in terms of a lot of people just want to do things to damage oil companies rather than engaging in those extractive industries and figuring out how to invest in making them better and making them less damaging. What do you make of this and where's it headed?
Yeah, I'm, you know, as I've said earlier, I would probably count myself as the last living communist in the city of London, in that being a Scotsman, I am slightly left-wing. But I do believe that this whole ESG nonsense is, to use a quaint Anglo-Saxon word, bollocks. It's just absolutely incredible how it's taken over the way of thinking. Now, back when I began in the markets in the 1980s, everything that ESG did, we did anyway. If you think about it, good corporate governance was always one of the reasons that you invested in a company. You invested in companies because they were well run and did what they said. And you invested in companies because they added to the sum of human wealth by not only paying your dividends, but made sure that they were going to be there next year to pay your dividends and pay your debt back. So that ticks the environmental box. And socially, you invested in companies that treated their workers well and made sure that everyone had opportunities. And that's always been true in investment. You don't need to have a checklist to do it. But as soon as you create a checklist, you turn that into bureaucracy. And the fastest way to slow anything down is to bureaucratize the process. And that's very much what's happened. And I want to just share an example of a recent deal that we've been trying to do here in the UK that illustrates where ESG has gone wrong. Now, at the moment, the UK is doing phenomenally well building wind farms. But each wind farm that you stick out in the Thames estuary requires 500 tons of steel. And to make that steel, the 500 tons of steel, you need something like 250 tons of metallurgical coal, which you burn with the iron ore to create steel. Now, at the moment in the UK, we import all our metallurgical coal from Australia, which costs massive carbon miles, and we import most of our steel from China, which again creates massive carbon miles. And all you're doing is all the pollution that we create for our steel that we use here in the UK, all that carbon is still being made in China. So all you're doing is changing the place. So one of our clients had a brilliant idea. Some of the best quality metallurgical coal in the world is sitting in an area called Cumbria on the west coast of England. And it would be really cheap and easy to mine it and export it round Europe, because the whole Europe is saying, this is crazy, we shouldn't be importing metallurgical coal all the way from Australia. Is there any we can use here? And we managed to do that. We got the concept in place. We got the planning in place. But then, of course, every single investor, including the UK's National Coal Board Pension Scheme, which pays the pensions of over 300,000 former miners, said, oh no, we don't want to do that. It doesn't fit with our non-carbon ESG policy. Tick box investment. Eventually, we did find investors, and at that stage, the government took fright because we're hosting a big environmental conference in the UK this year, COP26, and the governor in charge of that did not want to be associated with it if the UK was seen to be opening coal mines. Yeah, I agree that coal, we've got to get away from coal, and we've got to build more renewable power to improve the climate. I completely buy climate change. And if there's anything we can do to ameliorate the fantastic costs that are coming, let's do it. But one of the ways to do it is certainly to reduce carbon miles. But the result of this whole story I've just told you, the coal mine never got financed because the bureaucracy that ESG has created said no. And that, to me, is a massive failure of financial markets.
Bill, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview, but before I let you go, I want to ask you about what you do at Shard Capital. You're strategist and head of alternative assets. What is Shard Capital? We have primarily an institutional audience, but also for the benefit of our retail audience, and I guess the institutional as well. Please also tell us about Blaine's Morning Porridge.
Okay, right. Well, there's quite a story to tell there. Shard Capital is a fascinating firm. We started off 12 years ago as a small brokerage business, which was moderately successful. We took on some asset management businesses, which we are now focusing on and expanding. And for the benefit of your particular audience, I should mention a product that we have called LeafBridge. Now, LeafBridge, which is named after Leif Erikson and the bridge across the Atlantic that occurs in the middle of Iceland, the Atlantic Gap, is a fund that we've specially set up for American expatriates working in Europe. It solves all your investment tax issues for you, so it's worth thinking about. But otherwise, we have funds that invest in the credit markets, funds that invest in disruptive technology. Yes, we do disruptive technology as well. We just don't lose as much money as some others do. And Shard Capital has become very successful in these spaces. I was persuaded to come on a number of years ago because I knew most of the guys who were involved in it from a previous business I'd set up. My own background, as I said, had been in credit markets. I'd been head of debt capital markets for financial institutions at Bear Stearns before joining HSBC, and had then set off to try and set up a hedge fund just before the financial crisis began. And I found myself thinking this would be a mad time to invest in credit, but we quickly discovered that you could make loads of money broking credit, and the easiest thing to do was buy banks and sell it back to the banks that issued it a discount, creating them capital. And we used the proceeds from that trade to create a number of new businesses, which was very interesting. But I found the whole process of what was going on to be absolutely fascinating. And clients would ask, what do you think's happening, knowing that I used to be a financial institutions banker? So I started writing a comment every morning, and I was looking for a name for it. I thought, well, I'm a Scotsman. I have porridge for breakfast every day, and porridge is a very healthy breakfast, so I'll call it the morning porridge. And that's how it started. Started 12 years ago going to all my clients, and now it goes to over 7,000 clients throughout Europe and the States.
Well, Bill, I can't thank you enough, and we look forward to getting you back on the show in the future for another update. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor. Escrow.com is the payment system for buying and selling anything of value. Cars, boats, airplanes, jewelry, gemstones, fine art, collectibles, intellectual property rights, domain names, bringing in shipping containers from overseas, or even buying and selling entire businesses. It's simple to use. Either party sets up the transaction, then the buyer sends the funds to Escrow.com. The seller is then instructed to send the goods to the buyer to inspect. Within the inspection period, the buyer can return the items for any reason. After that, Escrow.com pays the seller immediately. Escrow.com is the world's most secure payment system from a counterparty risk perspective because the funds sit in escrow. Over 2 million customers have transacted over $5 billion on escrow.com, and eBay and Shopify use it for cars, boats, luxury watches, and business sales. It's available in the United States, Canada, and Australian dollars, euros, and British pounds. Never buy or sell anything online unless you use escrow.com. Escrow.com is a subsidiary of freelancer.com, listed on the OTCQX Best Markets under the ticker symbol FLNCF and the Australian Securities Exchange under the ticker FLN.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, I've been looking forward to Bill coming on to the show, and he didn't disappoint. I thought his views were really interesting. What did you take away from the interview?
Well, he echoed a view that I've expressed before on Macro Voices, which is when we get to runaway inflation, and we're nowhere close to that yet. You know, we're seeing what I think is the beginning of secular inflation. We haven't got to a runaway problematic inflation, but when we do, and I do think it's coming in the next few years, there's nobody who knows what to do. There's literally nobody in the industry that's, you know, hasn't retired yet, except maybe Charles Gav is still around, who I think was alive at that time, but he was beginning his career last time this happened. So there's a whole generation of professional finance people who don't understand inflation and have never had any experience with it, who are going to have to learn for the first time what to do when it starts happening. And I think it's a setup for a lot of real serious volatility in the markets when it comes. We're not there yet. It's probably years off. Who knows? Maybe it's only months off. But what's right now, Patrick, is let's hit our post-game chart deck, which this week is titled Post-FOMC Moves in the Markets. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com. Click on the red button that says looking for the downloads. Patrick, what do we have here on page two?
Eric, I just always want to start each week with the S&P 500 chart just to update the trend. And, you know, we're always looking for where are the key turn points in the markets. But there's one thing that is very clear that's been going on all year on the S&P 500, which is every dip has been bought. These corrections on average last just a few days. They all find mean revert down towards, in this case, the 50-day moving average does a great job of capturing that. And we're continuously breaking to new highs. And there's absolutely no reason to see why this trend is at risk at this moment. And so really at this stage, if the market follows its natural rhythm, we could certainly see advances toward 4,500 on the upside in the coming week or two. I was looking to see whether the FOMC meeting was going to be a catalyst that could potentially trigger some selling. We've seen that in the past. But at this stage, it really does look like a trend has been established, and there's no reason to believe immediately that it's reversing. And so I think at this moment, we have to respect this prevailing trend. Now, Eric, what I don't have on here is the chart of the S&P 500 equal weight index, which we have compared in the past. And it is worth noting that while I don't have the chart up here, that for the first time in months, it has actually broken out to a fresh new high. And so one of the things that we've been talking about is the lack of market breadth, and that we really needed to see the broader market start participating. And with the breakout of the equal weight, I asked the question as to whether or not that is what the market needed as a tailwind to make another bull advance. And so that's certainly on the radar for me to watch all of next week.
Let's move on to page three at the Euro-USD cross. Boy, it sure seems like the FOMC put a floor on that one, huh?
Well, we were at a major support line and we were losing momentum moving toward that support line. So it really isn't a big surprise that we're getting a reaction. And even a very typical reflexive snapback rally would easily take us to this 119, 120 level where the euro is slowly approaching. But the real information will come in the coming week or two as to whether this was exactly that, just an oversold bounce, and then we'll have a resumption in trend, or whether this strong dollar, weak euro trend that's been in place for 2 months is over. And I don't think 1 or 2 days is enough to already draw conclusions. But we do know a major support line is held. And on the short term, there might be a little bit more upside. But I think over the next week or two, this is a very important currency cross to watch to see whether or not this is establishing new trend or whether it was just an oversold bounce.
Let's move on to page four and look at my favorite subject, which is commodities. Boy, there was a significant resistance line. Looks like we're seeing a breakout.
Yeah, I think this is really interesting because we can we're looking at the Bloomberg Commodity Index futures, and what is interesting is that while oil's not at making new highs, there's all sorts of commodities that are off of their highs, whether it's copper, lumber, gold. You can take all of these commodities, even many of the grains, all pulling back. But yet the commodity index futures didn't get the memo, and they certainly are breaking 52-week highs and not looking back. You know, what is driving this commodity index? And more importantly, will we see a lot of these other commodities join the party? There was a really good breakout in copper, gold, and crude oil strengthening. And we'll look at some of these charts right now. But it'll be really interesting to see whether this kind of two-month pause in the commodity index futures that's been consolidating is over and whether or not a new bull trend resumes in this index.
Our regular listeners know my favorite commodity is crude oil, which we have on page five. What's going on here?
Well, I mean, I could ask you the same question, but in the end, Eric, what is interesting is just pointing out that correction that happened here in July went and tested all of those previous highs back in March and May. And as it made that pullback, what was and always is very interesting technical information is that when you have a correction, if the buy on dip traders immediately use that opportunity to buy it up and recover the price quickly to continue to show that the primary trend that was in play is still in force. And so far, the bulls have done a pretty good job recovering the price of oil, which in the back of my mind has me still thinking that the bulls may still have gas in the tank. What I think is the most important thing to watch is as we approach these previous highs, will the bulls be able to defend any selling pressure that comes there, and will they be able to break it out? If it does, there's a number of measured moves that target 80-85 on the upside, which would certainly be a huge tailwind to the cyclical trades and potentially even a reflation trade coming back in if oil was able to do that. Don't want to already be saying that this is money in the bank, but boy, this is something to watch into next week.
Yeah, you know, I think that it really is going to come down to whether or not those prognostications of big inventory draws continuing through American Labor Day, the one that happens in early September. If that holds true, I think we're going to at least 85. Of course, you never know. There could be some major news event, but barring something else, I think we're going much higher.
Right. So what I wanted to, though, touch on was energy stocks. And what is interesting about this to me, Eric, is that, well, look, okay, oil's right back toward its 52-week highs, and you're not really getting a big edge on buying crude oil necessarily up here. But what is interesting is many of those energy stocks that were benefiting from oil's trend since November through to the second quarter of the year have been in this multi-month correction. In this case, I have the XOP ETF, which is that Spider Oil and Gas Exploration Production ETF. They went through a 20% correction on this index, and there are some refiners and other oil stocks that are down 30%+ during this correction. And if oil was to break out to fresh new highs, it would be really interesting to ask the question as to whether these energy companies also establish lows and begin trending along with the commodity, because here you're able to buy the dip at a much more favorable level than chasing oil higher. And I'll be watching to see whether these energy companies start to get the tailwind benefit if oil does make that breakout.
Patrick, it's going to be very interesting because the Biden administration is not exactly a friend to the oil and gas industry. So although I think oil prices are going higher, how profitable oil and gas companies are going to be is really going to depend on the regulatory environment. Let's move on in any case, though, to gold futures. Boy, we're right on the line there, just flirting with that 200-day moving average.
Yeah, Eric. So I put on the simple moving averages because that's the ones you were referencing at the start in the market wrap. And we're actually at a really interesting moment. Like, first of all, the velocity of the breakout is relevant because we basically in one day were able to beat the last 2 weeks of trade range, which in itself is showing that there's some very motivated buying coming in this morning. And we're approaching a very key level for the breakout because when you look at almost all bull trends that have established on gold, they've done it above those moving averages. And we're really about to get the valuable information as to whether or not the sell-off that's more or less been, well, I mean, you could argue that the sell-off started back in the summer of last year, which spent most of the time below that 50-day moving average. But if we get above these moving averages into the next week or two, it'd be really interesting to see whether gold finally begins trending higher and whether this is finally the beginning of a gold move that we've been waiting for a while.
Well, the question too is going to be what happens to the gold miners if gold moves higher. Let's take a look at page 8 and see what's going on with the GDX.
Well, similarly, you've had consolidations in the miners, and in similar fashion, they didn't make lower lows than those February-March lows, and we're getting a nice breakout attempt on the upside of the gold miners. It will be really interesting to see whether all of this comes in. This is a very interesting moment for this move to start happening altogether, and all of them are breaking out. One day doesn't make a new trend, so I don't want to already come out and say that this is guaranteed to move, but this is how a lot of new trends begin. And so one of the key things to watch into next week is going to be whether or not gold and the gold miners and silver and all of those precious metals start to come to life, particularly since we're seeing real yields, you know, getting even more negative, which is typically a tailwind for the gold markets. And so anyway, that is what we got to watch for next week.
Folks, you can get Patrick's chart decks every single day with a free trial of Patrick's service, Big Picture Trading. Information's on page 9 or at bigpicturetrading.com. We're going to leave it there for this week's show.
This episode is brought to you by Abaxx Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better meet the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by escrow.com, the world's most secure online payment system from a counterparty risk perspective, because the funds sit in escrow.
Patrick, tell them what's in this week's Research Roundup.
You're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the chart book we just discussed in the postgame. There's also a link to a Mark Spitznagel article, At What Price Does Safety Come for Investors?, and a Jeffrey Snyder article, Leading Out from Japan. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at MacroVoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend, that's Eric spelled with a K, and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors.
Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.